Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 12th, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, content that we gathered at the National Homebrewers Conference in Denver, Colorado. In this episode, we take a look at an experiment designed by John Palmer, author of How to Brew, evaluating how water pH affects certain beer styles. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through the basic and more advanced brewing techniques. We got a lot of material, both audio and video, during our trip to Colorado, and I want to thank everybody who we interviewed out there. And over the coming weeks, you'll get to hear and see all that great stuff. And I want to give a special shout-out to Mike Lozano and Steve Oatley for shooting our stand-ups in our basic brewing video reports on Pro Night and Club Night. You know, sometimes you can't do everything yourself, and I appreciate the helping hands there. You'll hear Mike coming up in the next few weeks, by the way, in a special show on his mead-making efforts. He was kind enough to invite us into his home and feed us supper, even, and then treat us to some wonderful meads. And you can check out the Brew Bubba's video podcast to see Steve Oatley's handiwork. Steve's a professional videographer working in Detroit. And he put together a good report for the Brew Bubbas on the National Homebrewing Conference, so be sure to check that out as well. Well, before we get into our main content this week, let's take a look into the mailbag. Matthew from Dowling, Michigan, writes about bottle bombs. He says, I write today because of an unfortunate surprise when I returned from the lake. I had bottled some root beer, and you can probably guess where the story goes. Matthew says, I was reminded of the video of your six-pack IPA. 24 bottles are now 12. All discussion I find on the internet or books about exploding bottles is that it's dangerous and how not to do it. So my question is, what to do once you have the possibility? I have the picture in my head of your safety glasses and bubble wrap. How extreme should I take it? Or are the remaining bottles okay? Well, first off, Matthew, bottle bombs are a very serious matter. We joked around on the video podcast that you referred to about it, but it is very serious. I've had email from listeners who have been injured from shards of glass as their overcarbonated bottles burst in their hands or near them as they stood near the bottles. I wrote back and advised Matthew to quickly and carefully put his bottles on ice. I recommended that he use safety glasses and heavy gloves as he moved those bottles. Because if half of those 24 bottles had already burst, then I'd call that a potentially hazardous condition. You know, chilling the bottles would hopefully stop the fermentation and perhaps prevent any of the others from exploding. And to be extra safe, I advised Matthew to pop the tops on the remaining bottles after they've been chilled to release the pressure there. You know, making homemade root beer is tricky. When you're priming homebrewed beer, you're fermenting all the sugar out of the beer and then adding a very carefully measured amount of sugar for the yeast to eat in the bottle, providing the proper amount of carbonation. As you know, when yeast eats sugar, it makes alcohol, carbon dioxide, and a few other little small amounts of flavor compounds. But when you're making root beer, you have a ton of sugar in your bottles. And when you add yeast, you're essentially starting the timer on a bunch of little bombs if you're not careful and you just leave them alone. The trick is to let the yeast eat enough sugar so that you have carbonation, then stick the bottles in the fridge to stop the fermentation and stabilize those soft drinks. Now, if you wait too long, too much pressure builds up and then boom, you know, you can potentially get disaster. Now, I recently made a batch of root beer with my sons, and we used PET bottles, plastic bottles. And these are not only safer than glass if they burst, you can also check the status of your brews by squeezing the sides of the plastic bottles. Once they get tight, you can then start to cool them down and then check their carbonation levels kind of one by one. Depending on your preference for carbonation, it may take a few days after they initially get noticeably tight to the touch to get the carbonation level that you like. But the trick is not to forget them and to check them every day. very important. The only time I've had bottle bombs with my beer is when I was storing my homebrew in a closet off a small laundry room. The first summer after I started homebrewing, it got really hot in that room when that dryer was running, and it wasn't long until I found a sharp, sticky mess in that closet with bottles from one particular batch. And I quickly put that batch on ice and moved the rest of my beers to a cooler place in the house. By the way, Matthew wrote back with an update on his root beer bottle bombs. He says, no major issues with the overcarbonated root beer. Matthew says, I guess the high temperatures we've had contributed to the problem. I opened them with gloves while the bottles were in a covered trash can. Fizzy, but produced decent floats. Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad everything turned out okay. If you do everything right, if you pay attention, you shouldn't have to worry about bottle bombs, especially with homebrewed beer. If you make sure that it's fermented out, that all the fermentation is complete, and you make sure that you know, you've sanitized properly, and you don't have wild yeast in there to keep on eating those fermentable sugars after you bottle, you should be okay if you prime properly with the amount of priming sugar that you're supposed to. But you know, root beer, soft drinks, you know, it's a tricky stuff because you're wanting to get enough carbonated so that you get some fizz and you get a nice head on your root beer. But, you know, too much could be dangerous. I guess the safest way to do it is to make your root beer and keg it and force carbonate it with a tank of CO2. And that way you don't have to worry about overcarbonation from the yeast getting out of hand. Okay, that's the lesson on root beer and bottle bombs for today. Dave from Burlington, Wisconsin writes, maybe I need to go back and review some of the brewery tours on the video podcasts, but a curiosity has been nagging me. I assume the large fermenters at the breweries use airlocks, but I can't say that I recall seeing them. Is it correct that the brewery's fermenters have airlocks? And if so, could you capture a photo of one to place on the site or highlight one during a future brewery video tour? Well, Dave, most of the big craft breweries we've toured use blow-off tubes. If you look at the tour of a smaller brewery, Dry Dock Brewing Company, you'll be able to see one of those in action. Look for when you see the fermenters, look for the pipe and then the hose coming out of the top of the fermenter, leading down into a bucket of water, or it could be sanitizing solution. And I believe in that particular tour, I inserted a close-up shot of that bucket bubbling away. And, you know, in some breweries with huge fermenters, like those hoses are really cranking out the CO2, and the water looks like it's boiling. That pressure is coming out there so quickly. And in breweries like Avery in Boulder, the hop smell coming out of there is great. But you don't want to smell too long. Don't stick your head in the bucket and, you know, breathe through too long because, you know, you can't breathe CO2. Not good. It'll just knock you out. You need some oxygen every now and then. too much of a good thing can be bad. So just a little bit of hop aroma from a bubbling CO2 bucket is good. Okay. Well, let's get on into the meat of the matter today. You've heard John Palmer on this podcast spend an entire episode talking about the importance of pH in brewing to style. Check out the archives to find that episode, and you can get all the details there. Well, in that episode, John told us that the makeup of our water can have an impact on the flavor of our beers when we're trying to match a certain style. Well, at the National Homebrewers Conference, John had an opportunity to prove his point. And with the help of two brewers from the Keg Ran Out Club, Rick Bobbitt and Scott Jackson, John matched and mismatched water and styles. And here are the results. All right, John Palmer, welcome again to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you very much, James. Good to be here.
And you've got two companions here with you today, and I'll let them introduce themselves so we can hear their voices.
Hi, I'm Rick Bobbitt.
I'm Scott Jackson.
And you're with the Keg Ran Out Club.
That's right.
Here in Denver.
And you said it right. We appreciate that.
How do people usually say it?
Crocs or Keg Ran Out
Club, homebrew.
Homebrew Club. Or they, it's usually mispronounced somehow.
Well, I'm proud that I got it right. The rest of the day, the interview may be downhill from here. But you guys worked together to put together a presentation on pH. Mm-hmm. And we've done a whole show on pH. And this was kind of your chance to, this was your pudding to prove what you've been saying.
Yeah, this was kind of like the practical example of what we talked about in the pH show. Excuse my voice, Pro Brewers Night last night. But what we did is we built on what I presented in the pH show and in talking about where the beer pH should be when you're done brewing, where the pH of the mash should be, how residual alkalinity figures into that pH. We took that and applied it to two beers here. We brewed a pale ale and we brewed a stout, and we brewed those with waters that we built from distilled water using packages of various brewing salts. We built a pale ale water, high hardness, low alkalinity, and then we built a stout water with still fairly high hardness, but much more alkalinity to balance the dark malts. And then we brewed those same beers again, switching the waters. So we had four beers that showed the effect of mash pH and beer pH on the flavor of the style.
And before you guys took part in this experiment, did you guys worry too much about your water pH?
I had read John's book and looked at pH and started using 5.2 in my mash, and that seemed to help. But I really hadn't worried about it too much or thought about it too much.
I was concerned about pH, but not necessarily alkalinity, because I didn't have a way to measure that. I had a pH meter, so I could tell what my water was coming out. So I was concerned about pH, but talking with John and his presentation made me a lot more aware of what, you know, it's not just the pH, it's what's in the water. It's the mineral content and the salt content that really affects a lot of things.
And there is a combination of things that goes on, and there's a whole show in the archives if people want to to go back and check that out. But hit the high points. I mean, the 30,000 feet overview.
Sure. Well, the main drivers for pH in water are your calcium and magnesium content and your alkalinity. Alkalinity is mainly the bicarbonate level in the water. And your water pH is kind of a ratio of those two species. You can have a water pH of 8, and that's a typical drinking water kind of water pH, but that you can have that same pH number whether it's a very low mineral concentration or very high mineral concentration, because it's a ratio, it's a balance of those two groups. It's when you're brewing, you kind of need to be aware of whether you have 700-pound gorillas on the seesaw versus two little kids on the amount of adjustment you need to do. If you just got two little kids on the seesaw and you're sparging, that sparge water is not going to affect your mash pH very much. If you do with 700-pound gorillas, it's going to have more of an effect. So I think I probably went off on a tangent, but the high points are that, you know, your water pH is not terribly critical in and of itself. It's what comprises that pH and what those the calcium and magnesium and the bicarbonate effect has on the mash and your grain bill, because your grain bill also has a very large effect on the mash pH and thus the beer pH after fermentation.
Yeah, and that it's becoming, every time I hear you talk, John, it becomes more and more clear. So I'm
that's good.
and looking at the nomograph and, you know, kind of targeting, you know, where you want to be as far as your beer color and your beer style, it's really starting to make sense to me.
Oh, good. I'm glad. It's
crossed over to the dark side.
Yes.
So do you guys, are you starting to think about it more intuitively after this experience, or is it still kind of
No, out after there. After I read John's book, I had no idea what it meant. I mean, the first time. So I was like you. I had no idea. But listening to it over and over again and the balance of minerals and how it's really just the chemistry of the water that really affects it and how you can adjust the chemistry to fit your needs, then it makes a lot more sense.
And the key is knowing what water you have to begin with, because it doesn't make any sense to be adjusting your water when you don't know what it is to begin with. So you and getting the water reports from the city don't help. You actually need to get your water tested to tell you what's in it.
Yeah, that's very true. You can get your water report from the city, and that can give you a good jumping-off point. But very often those water reports from the city are an annual average. And so depending on your aquifer source, a lot of cities, you know, will pull from the river this time of year, pull from wells that time of the year, and the water will change. And yet the annual water report would reflect the average of those two sources. So that can kind of throw you off. So, yeah, you can save yourself a little bit of trouble by or aggravation by taking a sample and sending it to a place like Ward Labs in Minnesota. And for $15, they'll test the hardness and alkalinity for you and send you a report. Now you know what you're working with.
And I live in a small community, and part of the time we get our water from a local water source, and part of the time it's switched over to a regional water source. So that adds another variable into the equation. So if I'm really concerned about my water quality for a specific style, do you recommend starting with distilled water and building the water from the ground up?
Yeah, that's a good way to get around all those questions. That's in fact, that's what we did for this experiment, where we just started with distilled water, and I built packets of salts from calcium carbonate, gypsum, Epsom salt, baking soda, and ratioed those using a spreadsheet that's available on my website, howtobrew.com, and to calculate, iteratively calculate the right RA that we wanted for the style.
And RA is residual alkalinity.
Right, the residual alkalinity of the water that we were building from distilled. And so that's what we did. They got 5-gallon containers of distilled water, and I provided packets of salts. And oddly enough, these salts don't like to dissolve in right away. It may take 10 years for all I know, but we end up with a little pile of salt on the bottom of the bucket. So what we did instead was added the salts directly to the mash. The lower pH of the mash, once you put the grain in the water, the pH does drop down to, 5 to 6. And you can add the salts at that point, and they readily dissolve.
And talk about the two recipes that you designed.
Okay. We did a pale ale, which was about 7.5 pounds of Turo, 2.5 pounds of Vienna, a pound of Carapils, and 0.5 pound of Crystal 40. We gave it a 60-30-15 hopping schedule with Horizon, Amarillo, and Willamette. This pale ale had a IBUs of about 40 and original gravity of about 1050. The stout was a sweet stout type style, but I did kick up the roast content a little bit to help to emphasize the effect. Again, it was about a 1050 beer. The IBUs on this were about 35, I believe. I used only two hop additions, 60 minutes and 15 minutes, with Challenger and Willamette again, I think. And the grain bill for that was much more complex. Again, about, 6 pounds of Turo, pound of roast barley, 0.5 pounds of black malt, special roast from Brees, dark chocolate from Brees, and a pound of Carapils again. And 2 half-pounds of Crystal 40 and Crystal 80. So ended up with a sweet stout that actually kind of fermented out a little bit drier, not quite so much residual sweetness. Again, I wanted to emphasize the dark malt character of the beers, and so that people could readily taste the difference. from a small sample. And I think in the stout situation, it was much more noticeable. There's a much more difference in the astringency character of the beer between the stout brewed with the pale ale water and the stout brewed with the stout water.
And Andy Sparks just walked in. He just came in from a session, and I want to get Andy's input on the tasting. We're just talking about the process and what the experiment is, and we're just almost getting to the tasting parts. But were there any surprises in the brewing sessions? Anything that was out of the ordinary, other than the tasting the finished product?
Right. In the brewing of it, the whole key was to keep the water the only difference between the two batches. So we had to strike at the same mash temperature, sparge at the same amount of water, you know, use exactly the same temperatures. And even though, like on my stout, I hit really high, like 156 on the first batch, I had to do exactly the same on the second batch. So the whole goal was to brew them exactly the same, and I even did them in cereal. I was boiling the first batch, I was mashing the second batch, and we're taking readings of pH and temperature all through it to make sure everything was kept the same. So the brewing went pretty smoothly, really.
Yeah, the surprise for me was I thought going into it that the pH would pretty much balance itself after fermentation, because when the yeast do their chemistry, and I thought it would be the same, but they weren't. They were still a different pH after fermentation, and that struck me as something I didn't think about beforehand.
And let's talk about the tasting. Are we ready to talk about the tasting?
Sure.
Andy, for the pale ale, between the pale ale brewed with the pale ale water and the pale ale brewed with the stout water, what was your opinion?
Well, the first one we tried was the one that was the correct one with the pale ale water. And I thought it was is nice and clean. It had a nice hop aroma to it. It wasn't a big pale ale, so, you know, I think that was part of the goal, maybe, was to keep it subtle so that you could taste the differences in it. So I liked that one a lot, and I was kind of startled by the second one. It kind of shocked me how astringent it was, and the one that was brewed with the stout water. So,
yeah, I had the same experience when they sent me bottles a couple weeks before the conference, and they had sent their tasting notes also. So I poured them out, got out my BJPC CP judge sheets, and scored them. And the way I kind of summed it up was the pale ale with the pale ale water had a nice balanced hop character, very easy drinking beer. The pale ale brewed with the stout water was harsher, and it really had an unbalanced hop character, and was not as drinkable. I mean, still, it was a small difference. But definitely, I saw an improvement with the pale and pale.
But the hop bitterness for the pale with the good water was real nice and clean and sharp. But the hop bitterness brewed with the wrong water was harsh and just astringent and not good tasting at all.
I thought the color was also a little different between the two beers.
We didn't get a chance to see that because we had the samples one at a time.
Right, but seeing them ferment together in 5 gallons, the pale ale with stout water was a little darker than the pale ale with the pale water.
And there was some discussion with the tasting the first pair around of people who had different opinions on what they were tasting between the two, but I don't think anybody could argue that they were different, and they were markedly different. So, you know, people had different opinions on what they were tasting in each.
And what they liked as far as what they were tasting.
Right. And it could be that if they're brewing with the wrong water, maybe they're used to tasting it.
That's right. Yeah.
And if you're not entering contests and trying to match a style and you like that taste, you know, that's cool. There was, in my mind, even a more marked difference between the stout brewed with the stout water and the stout brewed with the pale water. Did you think, Andy?
Yeah, I agree. As a matter of fact, the stout brewed with the pale water, when I was drinking it, I was thinking, I've tasted beers like this, and that they're and it's kind of interesting. It wasn't very easy for me to drink the first one. I found it unpleasant on my tongue. It was a, and I describe it as a tannin, but I'm not sure that's exactly right. But it left me with this very dry, almost harsh dryness in my mouth. And I really liked the second one. It was very smooth and clean.
Yeah, that was my experience too. I tasted the first beer, and I tasted, you know, like a beer that I've drank so many times from commercial breweries. And it had, it had a one-dimensional roastiness to it. It wasn't terrible, but it was like many beers I've had before. And it's like, well, you know, dark beer, I want something a little lighter, something not so roast. And but the second beer, to me, had a much lighter taste, a lot more complex taste. I got some smokiness. I got some coffee, chocolate, a little dark sugar. I mean, there's a much more dimension to the flavor on this stout brewed with the stout water.
And Scott, the stout brewed with the pale water, I thought was very thin in that the flavor disappeared instantly. You drank it, you tasted the roast, and there was nothing else in the beer at all. Whereas the stout brewed with the stout water, you put it in your mouth and drank it, and it was creamy, and you could taste all these different flavors floating around in there. And like Andy said, the first one I found almost undrinkable, really.
Yeah, I found the same way with the stout and the pale. I especially thought brought out the maltiness of the beer along with the hops, whereas the pale ale with the stout water was just kind of thin. And didn't have a lot of dimension to it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Scott, in that I've tasted commercial stouts and porters that have that same kind of really sharp, roasty, in-your-face character that we got with the inappropriate water
with
pairings.
Nothing else to back it up. And so you get the roast, but there's nothing else.
Yeah, and you know, I've liked those beers. You know, they were drinkable, but compared against brewing with water that is tailored to that style, there was a marked difference. And I think among the vocal people surrounding me, you know, there was more of a consensus with that pairing.
Yeah, I think the difference was much more evident with the stouts. And I think it's just because of what we're drinking these days. We're drinking a lot of aggressively hopped pale ales and IPAs, and so you tend to set that amount of bitterness aside to some degree. With the stout, I think there's much more of a difference in terms of the acridness of the stout brewed with the pale ale water versus the creaminess and evident complexity of the stout brewed with the stout water.
And another interesting thing with the stout test that you couldn't see in there was the stout brewed with the stout water had a nice creamy head, and it lasted. The stout brewed with the pale water had almost no head, and this was, you know, pressurized the same way on my corny kegs when I did them for the test batches, and it just had no head and no lasting head at all, which is something to do with the proteins, with the pH or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I saw that even on the pale ales where the head retention differed between the two batches. It lasted the longest with the pale water. You saw that too.
Yeah. There's a reason why there are classic styles developed in classic cities, because their water was best suited to brew what they're brewing.
Yep, and it made the beer come out right, you know, visually, taste wise, and everything.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting was that if you were to submit those two, what they were basically stouts, you called them a sweet stout. They weren't super sweet. But if you submitted those into a sweet stout category, one would have probably got marked, this is more of a dry stout, this is, you know, whereas the one that was brewed with the right water had that, even though it wasn't very sweet, didn't have a lot of residual sweetness left, the creaminess and the smoothness of it and the balancedness of it lent that sweetness to the beer, and I thought it would have been scored much higher, you know, and wouldn't have been basically said, no, that's too dry for this style.
Yeah, not the style, yeah.
So conclusions. I mean, it seems like the evidence that, you know, John seems to know what he's talking about. And
not only
does it sound like he knows what he's talking about, but actual evidence backs him up on that.
I think with how John presents his book and his website and his presentations, that brewers need to pay attention to their water. And a lot of people don't want to deal with it, but a little bit of change can make a marked difference in the flavor of your beers.
Yeah, for me too. It's not only the pH. It's the mineral content, the salt content in the water. Look at what's in there and adjust your water to brew what you want to brew. I mean, you can adjust your water to be anything, almost, but you got to know what you start with.
Yeah. I talk about being the final frontier. You can brew without this knowledge, but once you brew with the knowledge, you can take what is a mediocre beer and make it, you know, exactly what you wanted, what you were hoping to achieve. And it made a real big difference in my brewing.
Get to know your nomograph.
Yeah. Well, and then let me hammer home one final point that I made in the presentation, is that the nomograph is designed to calculate residual alkalinity, and from that alkalinity suggest a beer color that's will combine with that alkalinity to get you your optimum mash pH and beer pH. People have looked at the nomograph and looked at the color scale and said, oh, if I want to brew a dark beer, I need a mash pH of 6. No, that's not what you need. You always need a mash pH of 5.4 to 5.8, or very close to that, for best performance. In the case of a high residual alkalinity water, if you mashed in with a high residual alkalinity water, pale malt or, you know, base malt only, you would probably get a mash pH of 6 rather than the 5.4 to 5.8. That's how that pH scale across there corresponding to residual alkalinity works. But it should be used to determine your water's residual alkalinity or the residual alkalinity of a water you're building, and thereby suggest a range of beer color that is suited for that water.
So maybe don't try to fight what you've got.
Yeah, In general, I think that's the way to go. I mean, especially if you don't know what you're starting with. You know, don't try to, look, I got to add, you know, tablespoons of this salt and that salt, or I'll buy this Burton salt packet, dump it in, and brew, if you don't know what you're starting out with. And I also don't advocate acidifying your mash to reach pH and acidifying your sparge water to keep that pH or the runnings, you know, like in the ideal range. I just think it's overkill. I think you can finesse it in and come up with a more complex or a more classical tasting beer if you start from the bottom up and say, what am I starting with? What salts do I need to add to come out with the way that the beer is intended to taste?
Very good. This is an interesting experiment, really interesting and useful, and I appreciate you guys putting it together and working up the beers.
I owe Rick and Scott a lot for brewing all four batches. It saved me a lot of time and a lot of transport, and I was just, you know, it really, and especially to have, you know, independent brewers testing this theory, and then have all of you tasting the results and saying, yes, it worked. You know, that meant a lot to me. That's very gratifying.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, James.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks again to John, Rick, Scott, and Andy for their help. And as I said, very interesting results, and more incentive for me to dig into my water chemistry. Haven't done it yet, though. Gonna, one day. By the way, Rick makes an excellent Pilsner, which I got to taste at the Keg Ran Out Club booth at Club Night. So good job, everybody. Next week, our coverage of the National Homebrewers Conference continues. Not sure what we'll have, but we got a lot of stuff to choose from. So it will be good, whatever it is. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop, where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In our first DVD, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we We walk you through the extract brewing process, step by step, from boiling to bottling. And in basic brewing, stepping into all grain, we walk you through the all grain process, from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online and we will pack it up for you ourselves, meaning me. Remember, shirts and hats out there too on our site, basicbrewing.com, including our ever popular Go Forth and Flocculate shirt. And thanks to everybody also who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are the Garmin Nuvi 660 Pocket Vehicle GPS Navigator and Personal Travel Assistant, and Netgear JGS 524NA ProSafe 24-port Gigabit Rack Mount Switch. There you go. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. We'll get a little slice of your shopping results there. Thanks, everybody. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson, who also did our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.